Welcome. This is an episode of the NMABC podcast, Conversations about Youth Mental Health in New Mexico.
Well, I am Amy Glass, the program manager for NMABC, which is a partnership between the New Mexico Department of Health and the UNM Center for Development and Disability. NMABC provides no-cost consults and training for providers who support youth mental health in New Mexico. And today we are here for a conversation about how pediatricians and other providers can partner effectively with parents and caregivers in caring for youth with mental or behavioral health concerns. And I would like to introduce our guest for today, pediatrician Dr. Karen Walsh, and I am so glad she could join us for this conversation. And I should disclose that out of all the pediatricians that I know, I asked Dr. Walsh to join me for this conversation because she served as the pediatrician for three of my children for 15 years here in New Mexico, and they each had quite unique needs, strengths, and challenges. Dr. Walsh, you were an absolute lifesaver for me as a parent dealing with some difficult issues. I felt supported, like I had a true partner in their care, and that the communication was really excellent, and my children felt that way too. So although we aren't going to discuss my children because of privacy issues, I am personally aware that you do an amazing job partnering with parents and have a lot of experience and wisdom to share here. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the wonderful introduction. It was a pleasure, and it was something that I truly enjoyed and enjoyed with many, many, many families over the years in primary care, and mental health and behavioral issues are near and dear to my heart. So I really appreciate the invitation and look forward to what we have to say here.
Yeah. And so first, I was wondering if you could just share a little bit about your background in pediatric medicine and what types of settings that you've practiced and where are you practicing now?
Great. So after training, I did work in a practice in an underserved area, northwest of Chicago in a suburban but underserved area. This was a brand new primary care practice. I was hired by a group of OBs who needed help taking care of the babies that they delivered. And so I saw a lot of newborns, but also there was a large group of families, including the families of the newborns that needed to be served. So there were two of us in that practice. I did that for a year. It was even more challenging than residency in a lot of ways because we didn't do as much primary care in residency, and it was a huge learning curve. A lot of my patients were Spanish speaking, so I had also a very large learning curve learning Spanish, because that was a lot easier than using translators all the time. So I learned a lot from the families, and it was a blend of all different kinds of cultures as well. The next year, though, my dream job opened up, and I was asked to work at the public health clinic at the University of Chicago, where I had trained for undergrad and medical school before going off to residency. And so I was there for 3 years as a primary caregiver and also medical director the last 2 years I was there. So I learned a lot about and that was an underserved clinic. So that was another area that I really enjoyed in that part of the city, which was on the south side of Chicago. I worked in child abuse there and also gained a lot of interest in mental health issues there. And along the way, we adopted a child from foster care, and I had a baby of my own, gave birth to a baby, I should say, not that the other wasn't a child of my own. And then along the way, we decided to move out of the inner city and ended up in Rio Rancho, working for Presbyterian. I was a primary care doctor there, and that's where I met Amy and her family and many, many other families in Rio Rancho and from surrounding communities as far as Santa Fe, Edgewood, Laguna, all kinds of the Pueblos Northwest. So it was, again, a very diverse population. And as everyone in New Mexico knows, New Mexico is quite an underserved community, and the mental health challenges here are tremendous as well. So I was there for 27 years, and then the last year and a half, I've been at the Presbyterian Downtown Newborn Nursery for a change of pace. So I take care of newborns and the families that are there for a short period of time. So I've had quite a bit of diversity, but often in underserved areas.
What an amazing career.
Challenging, but very rewarding.
All right. Well, I mean, as I know you already know, research indicates that mental health concerns and needs have increasingly been showing up in general pediatric practices. Is that your experience? And how do you see the frequency of those types of concerns increasing or changing over the past few decades or few years? And which types of issues did you encounter most frequently?
Definitely the mental health concerns have blossomed. I think there's always been, you know, a level of that. And in my training, we didn't do much of the mental health training. And I think that that continues to be the case, but there's much more of an emphasis on it in pediatric training than there used to be because of the shortage of mental health providers and child psychiatrists. I became interested because of my own personal experiences, and also in my practice, there was primarily the initial sorts of things were general behavior concerns in preschoolers and school age kids, and then also ADHD is also a big concern for a lot of families, and oftentimes isn't recognized until they're older school age and even later school aged. And now adults are quite recognized and being treated as well. And I learned a lot because of some of the challenges my child had that came through foster care, because that was a lot of children who have trauma and are abused end up with significant mental health issues, both genetically and behavior and environmentally. And so I decided I really needed a lot more training than I had gotten, other than just trial by fire in practice. And so I did a lot of extra workshops and long training programs, workshops, you know, 3 and 4 day training programs. And then some of the one that I specifically gained the most from had a component of 6 months of follow-up case studies that we did with group training. And so the most common ones now, and especially since the pandemic, in addition to the ADHD, is going to be anxiety and depression and dealing with substance abuse issues in the family. That's always been an issue. And then autism and recognition of the scope of autism. Although there is an increase in the numbers, but there's also a much broader diagnosis of children with autism that was a much narrower diagnosis in the past. So those are the kinds of concerns that we as pediatricians are seeing, all of those things in huge numbers. And a lot of it is just having to manage it ourselves because there's not enough providers out there. And so prescribing medications and then trying to help find therapists and being what I consider kind of a lifeline for a lot of families that just need to have some sort of support. And then partnering with schools is a really big piece of what we do, and helping the families navigate the school system and the mental health system.
That's a lot. When did you feel comfortable managing different kinds of conditions, and when did you feel like I need to refer this to a specialist, you know,
That's really going to vary from one provider, one pediatrician or nurse practitioner to the next based on their experience. And Presbyterian did offer quite a bit of training and workshops and such with some of the professionals within Presbyterian. And so So that was really helpful because they had inside folks to help us. And in our clinic, we had a child psychiatrist in the clinic, as well as two mental health providers that had pediatric training. And so we had folks to even just to consult with within the clinic and also to refer to. So that helped a lot because we could manage kids that we wouldn't ordinarily be comfortable with because they were there to help us out and no help with, oh yeah, we can take that patient. And the ones that the counselors did short-term treatment with maybe three or four visits, up to half a dozen visits. And then the community-based folks would be ones that would do longer-term, starting with, you know, children as young as 3 years old or so up through adolescence. And then also the psychiatrists and some of the other folks that work for Presbyterian could help us out with which medications to use and how to add medications and such. But you know, some folks aren't really as comfortable dealing with that and so would refer out sooner. But with the lack of access, we had to do a lot of that, whether we were as comfortable with it or not sometimes.
Right.
So wow.
Having the integrated behavioral health folks in your system was wonderful.
That was really huge. And a lot of places don't have that. And so we were very lucky and we had really good people. I mean, our embedded child psychiatrist is still fabulous and a huge resource and very experienced and very open to consultation. And so that was just wonderful for us. And for the families too, because it was somewhat seamless of a transition. And then she would send patients back, but we still, you know, for us to manage after things stabilized. And then she was still a resource if we had concerns or questions. So it really was a very, very nice system, or is a very nice system for families, because they felt like they had a team of people helping them out. And sometimes that worked well with schools as well, that we would be able to help with helping folks understand the whole system of what an IEP is and what different services are at school. And we could sometimes work with the specific people at individual schools and what their rights were, and that there are advocates to contact at the school system that can come and be with them at IEPs, that they do have, you know, district and even school specific parent volunteers and such, or professional volunteers that can come to the IEPs and help be their advocate to help understand that system as well, because that can be very daunting.
Yeah. So in addition to your own clinical knowledge, you're bringing in knowledge about resources and how the systems interact, and that's
great. Yeah.
Yeah. If only every practice could have those. All those.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I learned so much and eventually adopted a second child through CYFD. And that was probably my biggest learning tool, was living through these experiences on my own and being able to empathize with families that had kids with significant mental health issues, because not only did I have the book knowledge or what I learned from professionals, I was living that experience and understanding the pitfalls of it and the emotional and physical drain that brought on. And it's a lifelong kind of commitment, because that just doesn't go away when a child, you know, matures and leaves the home. So, you know, so I have, you know, I still have my trials and tribulations, and so I still can empathize with, you know, with what's going on, because their past traumas don't just disappear.
Right. No, this is a huge question.
Sure.
What do you see as the biggest pitfall or area of potential missteps for pediatric providers who are dealing with mental health concerns in their practices?
You know, I think it can be important to create a safe relationship and to listen, but also to meet people where they're at. Because sometimes the parents are overwhelmed, sometimes they're angry, sometimes they don't understand what's going on for them or for their children's, for their children, I'm sorry. And they often aren't as objective about their own child. I mean, none of us is totally objective about our own child. So so it can be really difficult to find that middle ground and to offer advice, but try not to be too harsh or too lenient in terms of what your perspective is. And I think it is trying to find the dynamic within the family and then how to help them interact with the professionals, because they feel most parents feel very, maybe subservient's the wrong word, but they feel like they're caught because the people both in the schools and in the health systems and other systems have some power over them, because they are telling them, this is what you have to do, and this is what's wrong with your child, or this is what the way the system works. And so they feel very disempowered. And so trying to find a way to help them understand that even if their child has a problem, it doesn't mean that that means there's something bad, that they've done something wrong, or that there's something terrible about their child, or if there is a concern, that they have to try and work again as a team to find what's best for the kid. And oftentimes a child themselves or the parents feel like they're being targeted, and that people aren't, are just thinking their kids are bad and want to just get rid of them or get rid of the problem. And so, threading that fine line can be difficult, and we try and be the go-between in some ways and try and empathize, but also sometimes there has to be, some recognition of their emotional state and trying to be more objective about what is really best for the child, and for us to listen and try and hear where they're coming from and not be judgmental, because it is hard sometimes to not just say, if you would just listen to me, I could really help you. And, there are people that are very anti-medication, but sometimes if you do it right, that can just make a child's life so much better. And that, I often had to tell parents, I don't get any kickback from prescribing medication. I'm doing this and recommending this because of the many experiences I've had. And it's not a forever thing. It's if you try it and it doesn't work, then we stop doing it. And if we try something else and it doesn't work, it's a process, not a sign on the dotted line contract. And so I think that when people could understand that I was a partner with them, or if you can try and partner with them and not just say, this is it, and if you don't do this, then I'm not gonna trust you or take care of you or your child, and make it, an open-ended, just listen, hear me out, and then you get to make the decisions, but at least hear my perspective, because this is what I do and I'm trying to do the right thing.
Bringing a collaborative kind of model to the communication and trying to be empowering with caregivers who may feel very disenfranchised, right, or disempowered, and being strength-based. Boy, how wonderful. On the other end, what advice do you have for parents and caregivers in working effectively with their pediatricians or other primary care providers?
I see it as a give and take, that we each have our roles, and that you have to say, look, this is my perspective and this is what I expect for you to do, is to communicate and tell me what your perspective is, and to expect less non-judgmental kinds of care, and that you can expect that you can have expectations of me that I will respond, or that my office will respond, and that we will listen and be caring, but that you can't just call and demand things this moment, that there is going to be some responsibility on your part to call at the right time for refills or call with some respect for how long it might take to get an appointment or to leave a message and know that it, you know, to know that there are going to be boundaries, but that your child will always be a priority to us. And, yep. And you know, that there are going to be things that we don't have control over, like a pharmacy being out of a medication or the school having this or that ridiculous rule or, you know,
right.
And that we can't necessarily write notes that say that your kid was out of school and had this illness if we don't know what really is going on, or, you know, just simple logistical things.
Yeah.
But that we will do the best that we can do to provide the best care for your child.
And, you know, you were kind of going in this direction and talking about medications, but there is considerable stigma around mental health issues and medication for mental or behavioral health concerns. Do you have any tips for how providers can address some of that stigma or alleviate concerns that families have about what it means to have a mental health concern?
Absolutely. I do think that there are times that, you know, that medication's not needed. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, let's try something else first. Let's, you know, it depends on the concern, of course. I mean, there are some issues that don't need medication. And there are some cases where we try it and it doesn't work and it isn't necessary. I'm a huge advocate for going to therapy, whether it's for depression, anxiety, even for ADHD, certainly for things like autism. There are wonderful therapies that sometimes get a really bad rap because people spend time on the internet reading terrible things about certain types of therapy without really understanding. They just hear what one person's comment is or a whole thread of comments about this is terrible and it's, you know, abusive to your child or what have you, without really understanding what the modality is. And that's true of lots of different kinds of therapies. And then also with medications too, that they're absolutely wrong and they're dangerous, and anything that's done inappropriately, whether it's an allergy medicine or a heart medicine or anything like that, has to be done with care and dosed appropriately and followed appropriately. And so I think that, you know, not just saying, oh, your child absolutely needs medication. If you don't do this, you're a terrible parent, which I think is what a lot of parents hear. Or, you know, whether it's just the message isn't being delivered in a, you know, in a kind and caring way, or in a way that makes the parent feel like they're part of the process, you know, I think is really huge. And, you know, sometimes one parent's on board and the other parent isn't. Sometimes the parents don't live together and it becomes a big battle. And so those are the kind of things that both as parents and providers, we need to, again, create this relationship that really, so that we trust one another and know that, you know, that the parent does have a say in it, and the child as they get older has a say in it, and that we monitor really regularly whatever medication it is. And although interestingly, there are studies like with kids with ADHD, where they, it was in an adolescent population where they had the kids take the medicine and do some kind of a testing, short-term testing, and then they had them not take the medication over a span of several days, and then got the parents' reaction and the scores of this testing and the kids' reaction. And the kids said they had much more focus when they didn't have to take the medication. And the parents or teachers said the kids were much more focused and the scores were much better when they were on the medication than off the medication. So that sometimes a subjective, oh, I I'm so much more creative and I think so much better when I don't take the medication, yet the objective scoring showed that they actually performed much better on the medication. So sometimes a kid's perception of, you know, how they behave or how they, this was more about focus and concentration and not necessarily behavior, because it was just a simple, you know, scored test in an area that they had been learning. But it was oftentimes what we see, and it was like a 14 or 15 year olds. So when you ask little kids, they oftentimes don't have a clue whether they're, and in my own kids, I could tell within 15 minutes with my oldest son if he'd taken his medication or not, because his voice was totally different. He had a high-pitched, really fast tempo to his speech, and an hour after taking it, that totally changed. So if he said, "Oh, I took my medication, I'm doing just fine," you could tell right away. It's like, "I don't think you took it," and you know, and he had no, he just wasn't able to recognize that he was not able to focus or to manage. So you know. But as they get older, they make their own choices about that.
What's it like for you when the caregivers or the older youth, you know, decide not to follow recommendations for therapy or medication or anything, right?
Well, I think then you just, you know, especially if the child and the parents are on board, you know, I just say, well, you know, that's certainly your choice. And, you know, I'm not going to stop taking care of you unless it's another, you know, if it's not a behavioral kind of medicine, but it's right. Like a asthma medicine or a diabetes medicine or something like that, then I might be a little more forceful that it's dangerous. You know, I think you have to try and respect, you know, say, I don't necessarily agree, especially if the parent wants the child to do something and the child just refuses, you know, that can be really hard. In some kids' cases, it is very dangerous because they do really impulsive or dangerous things, or if they're depressed, they're doing self-harming things or that kind of thing. But you have to just, you know, say, this is really not what I recommend, and I really feel that you'd be better off doing this, this, or this, but I'm not going to, you know, very rarely will you say, I won't see you anymore because of this. But you can also say, I'm not sure that I can help you with what's going on for you, because this is the advice I'm giving about X, Y, or Z, and I think we've reached an impasse here. So if you want me to continue treating you, you're welcome to come back. But if your answer is still going to be completely different than what I'm recommending, I don't know, you know, that we're going to make much progress.
Yeah. So just this is the way things are, right? This
yeah. Yeah.
And
if you don't agree with that, you get to make that decision. It's not my decision to make. My job is to give you the advice that I think is correct, but you as a family get to make those decisions.
Yeah. And what about follow-up care? So, mm-hmm. You know, one of the ways that you provided wonderful care for my family was through all those brief follow-up phone appointments to check on current dose or side effects or just general, you know, mood or how are they doing. And I also know that as a parent, it's really hard to make time for, you know, for appointments because you're always moving from one crisis to the next.
Absolutely.
Well, hopefully not, but, you know,
right.
That's how it feels. You know, and routine follow-up can feel lower priority, like, oh, they're fine, you know, so we don't need to talk or we don't need that appointment. How do you encourage that important monitoring and, you know, keeping track of how things are?
I think definitely the follow-up is very important when you're talking about a mental health issue of any kind. And I mean, ADHD falls into that category, although, that's not as intense as maybe a depression that a child's can be very up and down, especially the adolescents, but even the younger kids. And I think that, you know, we do, sometimes it can be a quick phone follow-up. Sometimes if it's a younger kid, it can just be with a phone, you know, when it's a med follow-up, just make sure that, you know, do you feel like the kid's doing okay? And do you feel like there's a need for a dose change or what have you? We keep really close track of when we change doses. And if it's been a dose change, then we want a more sooner follow-up. If someone's been on a dose for a long period of time and doing well, then a video visit at 3 to 6 month intervals should be fine. We do like to see in person every 6 to 12 months for any kind of mental health sort of thing. And when they get older, a lot of times I'll do a video visit with the adolescent. And some of the kids are in counseling, so that's not as much of a concern. But if they're not, you know, some of the kids, because I've often have developed relationships over a long period of time, the kids are sometimes more comfortable talking to me about things because I've known them since they were much younger and will tell me things that they don't necessarily want to talk to their parents about, or that unless there's self-harm or something like that, that I'm really concerned about, then I often will tell them, we need to bring your parent in, or you need to tell me when you talk to your parent about this. Or with a counselor, they may not see as often, or they may not be as volatile and may not need to talk to a counselor, but just to kind of get a sense of what's going on for them. And I found that because I had those relationships, the medication follow-ups were also a good way for me to check in. And I felt comfortable with some families or some kids to do that with those checkups. And sometimes it was every couple of weeks, and other times it was every 3 months or so. So I think it really varies on each situation and each person and each family, how frequent those would be. But definitely that needs to be done on a fairly regular basis with any kind of mental health medication, or especially with any changes.
And how do you, pediatricians and primary care providers are dealing with the need for very brief appointments and, billing expectations of how many people get seen and how long they're seen for? And how do you try to balance excellent patient care and service with those real world demands?
That was a huge challenge. And especially when, after COVID, when there was just a huge number of kids that, really had significant problems going back to school, and it varied on their ages. The kids who were right in the middle school really changed because they didn't have that developmental interaction with their peers that's so important in 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And then some of the high school kids got completely thrown off. Their social lives were not, were not normative. And they're still having repercussions from that. And some of the young kids going into kindergarten or first grade didn't learn social skills that they needed to learn at that point. So it just threw the world for a loop, and it really affected kids. And so I think that part made it even harder, because we did nothing basically except video visits for 2 years, and then everything just came crashing in. And so it was hard because we were under a lot of pressure to ramp back up and see people. And some of us just, we could bill for longer visits and had to build those in. But again, we were not wired to say, okay, well, sorry, time's up, you got to go, because that's just not who we are as pediatricians and primary care doctors. We're just not wired that way, and we don't practice that way. So unfortunately, I used to stay on time really, really, really well. And after the pandemic, my timing just didn't work that way anymore. And even regular well child visits ended up being longer, because it was rarely just, oh yeah, everything's great, see you in 6 months or see you in a year. It just, because everybody's life was upended. And yeah. So that became very challenging. And there were a much larger percentage of kids that were just not coping and became suicidal and became very depressed. And again, I wasn't willing, and most of my partners weren't willing, to just brush it off. And there was nowhere to send these young people to get care. And so it was exhausting. And so the hours in the office and documenting all this, because the next time you see somebody, you have to remember what you guys talked about the last time, or you're not really doing your job well. So now there's a lot more AI in the charting that can happen in primary care, which I'm not as familiar with, but from what I hear from my colleagues, it's really made things easier to document. And so that's made a big difference. But, you know, 14 and 15 hour days were not unusual. And so, and that was emotionally draining because, you know, no matter what you do, you're going to care about the people you take care of. And again, long-term relationships don't just disappear or don't just become unimportant. So, so it was always difficult to work within the parameters of what the administrators felt was appropriate. And then it just became even untenable in my mind. So, and that was one of the reasons that, I mean, after doing it for over 30 years, all told, I just couldn't keep up with that anymore. Emotionally, it was more of an emotional and physical drain. And so I needed to do something a little bit different. And not because I didn't enjoy what I was doing.
Right.
You know, and I probably had the largest number of, I mean, our group saw a lot of mental health issues, but I've always been drawn to that, like I said, and always had that kind of experience that was very important to me. And so.
Yeah. And I know there are a lot of primary care folks who say that even when it's not the presenting concern, that mental health is part of, you know, 95% of visits as just one
absolutely
element.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, and it took its toll on a huge, I mean, the mental health toll and the suicide rate of physicians has skyrocketed in the last 5 or 6 years. And it does, it just takes away so much emotional energy that it becomes something that is either you have to shut down and not care, or you have to just really give up a huge amount of who you are.
Yeah.
And it's sad because we go into this profession because, especially in pediatrics, I went into pediatrics because I found that when I did my training, the pediatricians were the happiest people that I worked with, and that you could laugh every day. And I still laughed every day. I still smiled every day, even when it was hard, because it just was where the joy was. And I couldn't see myself taking care of adults who didn't always take care of themselves for the rest of my life and take care of diseases that they created themselves. I mean, this was when I was 26, 27 years old, and I was like, I just can't do this forever. You know, I want to be around people who have joy in their life and who, you know, and the providers all had joy in their life, in their day-to-day. And I still, that's still every day, even as hard as it was, I still found joy in what I did. It was just that it wasn't enough to get me through the difficult part of it. And so, which, you know, I had to just kind of raise the white flag, because I just, after 30 years of it, I couldn't keep that pace up. And I didn't want to stop doing this job, you know, doing something.
Right. You know, and my background as a therapist, you know, we're very aware of secondary traumatic stress and vicarious trauma and you know, those things that impact our work. And I'm not sure there is as much attention to that in primary care and pediatrics, even though you're having these crammed full days with a lot of mental health issues.
Yeah. And they tried, but the need is so great. And this is a state where the need is even greater than most places. Although, I mean, I read articles and read about some folks that were in rural communities in like Kentucky. This woman was the primary care pediatrician for this huge area. And she was the only game for like counties, and her load of mental health treatment. I read that and I was like, okay, we don't have it that bad. This poor woman was just inundated. And I thought, I don't know how she survived the 2 or 3 years of what was described in this article, journal article that I read. And I thought, oh my God, you know,
some of our rural areas in New Mexico where they don't have primary care providers.
Right. And I just thought, oh my goodness, I could never have done it without the partners I have around me. The group I was in was just, is incredible. It's an incredible group and huge amounts of support. When you have a tough day or a tough patient, there's always somebody to go to and just say, I just need to talk a minute. This really, really shook me up. And we did that for each other all the time.
And that's a lovely segue for me to again say that NMABC offers case consults with our UNM child and adolescent psychiatrists.
Okay.
For providers who don't have integrated behavioral health or don't have those supportive group practices. So they can call and get that kind of support and have it feel like a team kind of approach, even if they are practicing in remote areas. So
that's huge, because that was something, that we sent a lot of kids to the developmental and disability clinic for evaluations, which is a wonderful place. It's just that you have, again, don't have enough providers to be able to keep up because there's just such a demand. Yeah. And when they go there, they get the best and most thorough evaluations anywhere. And we've always said, if you want to get the best, you have to wait, but you'll always get an amazing evaluation when you go to the CDD at UNM. So,
and the CDD is really working on those waits. So,
oh, I know they always have. It's just that the need seems to continue to grow no matter how many providers you have.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, are there any last thoughts that you'd like to share with other providers?
I think just try and learn as much as you can, use your colleagues for help, and just know that everything that you do has value. And the more you can learn and the more you can listen, the more you can help the community.
Wow. Oh, that's a fantastic place to wrap it up. I really appreciate your time and sharing your experiences in such a genuine and thoughtful way.
Well, I appreciate having worked with you and your family and knowing that, that you're giving back to the community, because, you were always just so kind and caring. And obviously your family, had someone that was going to be there for them. And I think that's what kids need. Because we all make mistakes. None of us is perfect parent. And we all need to just plow through it.
Plow through it. That's our yes. All right. Well, thank you for talking today. And
absolutely.
Wishing you all the best.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the NMABC podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please get in touch with us at nmabc@salud.unm.edu. We also want to thank Batchbug and Shozik for the music included here. NMABC is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The views expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government. Thanks for listening.